Welcome to Life 2.0. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you back one more time. This is the 65th time that you and I are converging in this particular place in time. So glad to have you back with me. And you know, before I get into what we're going to talk about today, let me see if I can find this article. I can't. Hold on. I got a lot of stuff here. Hold on. This is some like background noise. I wasn't planning on grabbing this right away, but I'm going to go for it. Here it is. There it is. A bunch of stuff fell on the floor. It's all right. I'll get it later. Eric Zorn, who is a fantastic writer for the Chicago Tribune, has kind of covered the gamut of business and arts and entertainment over his career as a writer and as a columnist. And he had something out this past Sunday in the big paper, the Chicago Sunday paper, which weighs 19 pounds. Can Luminary entice podcast listeners to pay? It went on to talk about how Luminary, which is a heavily capitalized startup, that for $8 a month will offer packages of more than 36 exclusive audio programs starring Conan O'Brien and Lena Dunham and Trevor Noah and Chicago's own David Axelrod. They are pay-to-listen podcasts, which has been around really since podcasting started about 20 years ago. But for the most part, they've been niche products aimed at devoted fan bases. That would be you and me. And I found this fascinating because on one hand, for $8 a month, you can get all this programming, which means they're banking on the fact that probably 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 million people will want to hear this for $8 a shot. And you start multiplying that, that turns into some serious cash. But they're starting with $100 million in funding and really the stated goal of becoming the Netflix of podcasting. So on one hand, that's why we have two, because we'll start with the one on the left. On one hand, I am so very, very thankful that about 40 people see fit and have value in the fact that they plunk down $20 a month, $5 a week, 66 and a half cents a day to listen to the rants, raves, the wisdom, the ups, the downs, the ins and out, all the stuff that I've covered over the last 65 episodes. That's $20 a month. I don't have any funding capital laying around to push this and do a bunch of things. So thank you so much for doing that. It was just, it kind of struck me as this podcasting thing starts to ramp up and they look at the big numbers and how to make even more money on this. And the technology is fantastic. You know, anytime I feel the whim, I could open up the bag and pull out all the audio stuff and off to the races we go. And then there's a podcast. And then, as I mentioned, 40 people once a month get dinged for $20 off their credit card. And that keeps this thing going. And of course, more than 40 people listen to it, but those 40 people allow that for the rest of the world to listen as well. So on one hand, I am so very, very thankful that even though I've been in radio 20 years plus, that there are 40 people on the planet who find enough value to plunk down $20. On the other hand, this is like the death knell for guys like me. If I don't, you know, to expand out, $20 would seem like an enormous amount of money. When you can get Conan O'Brien for $8, I don't know that I'd want to listen to Conan O'Brien for $8, but the point is, it's getting to where the saturation is going to start overtaking a lot of these businesses. And if somebody can put $100 million, that's serious cash, $100 million in the bank to as an upstart, it reminds me a little bit of what went on with satellite radio. When I had the opportunity to work at SiriusXM with the Oprah Radio Channel, before I went there, I thought, no, who in the world is going to pay for this? I mean, you get radio for free now. I mean, it's paid for by commercials. You have to endure commercials. But you don't have to physically, you know, plunk down any money to listen to some audio that you want to hear. You just turn on the radio. And then you endure the commercials or you turn them off or what have you. But everything is paid for by sponsors. They're banking on the fact that if they repeat their message enough, that you will buy their products. And in order to reach you, they got to use that platform. And in order to use the platform, they got to pay for it. All the money that is generated from commercials is simply based on a quarter-hour listenership, and then they determine how much a 30-second commercial is worth. And some of it comes up and down, meaning if you have a flagship station that's been around a very long time, even though they may not be the station they used to be, they have a little bit of a heritage knock to them. And so people will stay with it kind of out of a loyalty thing. And on the other hand, if you have somebody who's, you know, reaching, 5 million people, the prices are going to cost you. So that's the traditional terrestrial radio model. And when I went into SiriusXM, I thought, who in the world, again, is going to pay to listen to radio. See, they were smart enough to offer you the music stations, which is the most popular thing on XM. Now it's just called Sirius. It was Sirius XM when I was there in 06 to 10. They give you the music stations free, which is smart because all the commercials on the other end of it, I know most of the other the news channels, things like that, that's what pays the bills, in addition to the fact that you pay per month a subscription to have listening on demand, as it's called now. So there's those things are all working. But I never thought it would last. Honest to Pete, I never thought that SiriusXM would ever garner enough subscribers to make it profitable. And, you know, they're really not. They bleed money all the time. They had billions of dollars. I mean billions. I personally saw about $35 million go out the window in 36 months. But that's a different show. The point is that if somebody's behind you with some serious coin, you can endure until you're able to create the niche that you need to have for people to find you. So I don't know who, there's actress, writer, director, producer Lena Dunham is signed up to be a podcast on Luminary, and funny man Conan O'Brien will be there. They have $100 million sitting behind them, and for $8, and I'm, you know, you can go out there if you want, but for $8, you're going to get that stuff. For $20 a month, you get me. So I'm not really sure what I'm getting at here, except for the fact is that I'm very, very thankful that that I've been doing as long as I have, that there is a segment of society out of the 7 billion people on the planet, 40 people, are more than willing to support this. And sometimes we get a few more. Sometimes we lose a few. It kind of comes and goes. I don't know what the wedge point is or the leverage point is, if it ever kicks in more than that. And there are days I wonder if this is the thing I should be doing or not. But 65 episodes in, here we are, and that's enough of that. And quite frankly, this was a rough run. This was a rough one for me. I'm going to leave that in because I thought it was kind of funny. There's this siege of pollen going on. I have the vaunted Life 2.0 studio locked down. I don't want any of it in here. It's already gotten into my ears, my eyes, my nose, and my throat. And I'm, you know, I went and got the high-end, over-the-counter stuff. I won't say the name because it ain't working, and they might sue me. But I'll tell you, let me just say this. Wouldn't it be great if when you're watching television, you see these allergy medicine commercials that they work like they did on TV? You know, you take the allergy medicine, and, you know, within like 14, 15 seconds, you're dancing around the yard, and everything's in slow motion, and the sun is shining, and your eyes aren't itching, and it's all perfect. I took this 3 hours ago. I'm still waiting, so... And finally, before I mush on to what we're going to talk about, at least what you're going to hear on Wednesday Wisdom for $20, not $8, but $20, I got these Halls mentholiptus going big time. You know, just like a sore throat and dry. And I don't want to sound totally like Michigan J. Frog. You know, the guy on Hello, My Baby, Hello, My Honey, Hello, My Ragtime Gal. You remember that cartoon on Looney Tunes where the guy finds the frog? And he's like in a building they're tearing down, and he sees this frog, and the frog's dancing with a top hat and all that stuff, and he sings that song. Do you know what I'm saying? I sound kind of like that without the Halls. So anyway, I'm opening these Halls, and I didn't realize, if I did, I'd forgotten, that somebody had the brilliant idea to put little sayings on the Halls mentholiptus wrappers, on all the Halls. These are cherry, I think. And I opened it up, and it says a pep talk in every drop. That's brilliant. You talk about great advertising. People are grabbing these things all the time and looking at them. So here's what the three messages that you need to know today, courtesy of Halls. There's their plug. They didn't pay me for this. There's the plug. And these actually do work, by the way. I've been using them for years. The first thing says, you know, I just flatten this little piece of paper out. Don't give up on yourself. That right there is a little mini pep talk. It's easy to do, to give up on yourself, especially when things are difficult. But it's never worth it in the long run. And I think it's just a nice little reminder. Don't give up. Delay and denial are not the same thing. So don't give up too early. You can do it. And you know it. I always find this interesting. You know, if you drive a certain route in your car and you've done it more than, you know, a handful of times, you actually can kind of run the in your head how this is going to go. Oftentimes when I go into the city, this little file drawer opens up. And I can remember where the streets are, which I haven't been on in 25 years. And so I think that sometimes we sell ourselves short when we're working on something. And there may be some experience you had many years ago that can help you doing what you're doing now, but you just forgot about it. And pretty soon you stop for a second, take a deep breath and go, oh, I know how to do this. And then you go and you do it. And finally, this is the one I think was meant for me. It says, the show must go on. this is the same in, you know, for me, both ends of it. It's not just a show, but it's also work for me. And that was a bit of a struggle to get all that out. But listen, today is the Wednesday Wisdom episode. It's the 65th episode of the Life 2.0 podcast. And what I've been doing in certain instances when I come up with Wednesday Wisdom, instead of me just bloviating, speculating, and pontificating, I have vast audio archives of conversations I've had over the years with some incredible people. And I really ought to sit down and make a list, you know, like a top 20 kind of thing of the people that, when I'm with them or have spent time with them, they help me get out of the place that I'm in that moment. And then listening to their story always validates some way, shape, or form my own existence. Because when you hear about what other people have gone through, because we get so myopic on our own journey, oh my God, this is the worst thing in the world. Yeah, it might be. And then you hear something else and go, wow, I didn't have to deal with that. Rhonda Britton would be on that top 20 list for sure. When she was 14 years old, her father shot and killed her mother while she watched just a few feet away. And then he turned the gun on himself and he took his own life right in front of her. She carried the weight of that day for 14 years, living a double life. The facade that she showed the world and the torture she lived inside, obviously at opposite ends of the spectrum, until one day when everything began to change, she found a way to step out of the darkness that had her in such a very tight grip, to let go of the guilt and the fear, and to finally begin to reclaim her life. And those years since, she's become an acclaimed author, speaker, and really a catalyst for personal change. She's appeared in television shows and launched the renowned Fearless Living Institute. And so on this Wednesday Wisdom, I thought it was appropriate to go back to 2016, a conversation that Rhonda and I had and what was then called Life Matters. Here you go. Hey, welcome back to another edition of Life Matters, the show that matters. Why? Because I said so, that's why. And if you're interested enough, and I've hooked you in the cheek and other parts of your anatomy for the last 5 months on these shows, you're not going to want to move away at all from the dial, even if there is a dial, I don't really know, on digital radio, but it doesn't give a shit. There's something there that's keeping you there. Because it is rare for me, especially in this business, to have a human being in front of me in a studio. For the most part, these people, because of technology, and I get that, they check in from various parts known and unknown on the planet. And when I found out that Rhonda Britton, the Rhonda Britton, Fearless Living Institute, you know, the life coach with the most, all that kind of stuff, big time all over the planet, was actually going to be in Chicago. I used unsocial media. I got a hold of her on Facebook. Well, that shifted everything. So I'm just going to give you a little backstory in this. It had to be 19, none of your business what year it was when Rhonda Britton was first on my show in Michigan, WCHT, where the big names come to talk. And I knew, had read Rhonda's first book and gone through that. I knew her story a little bit. And I'd have to go back and find the tapes of some of those shows. But it was astonishing to me what she had gone through, what she had brought to the table from that, and what she brings out to the world. So I'm not going to, I'll do the rant on the back end of this once I kick her out of the studio, but I just wanted to let you know who you're dealing with today. She's a formidable human being who cuts no slack before her time. Welcome to Chicago.
Thank you, John. It is so great to be here. And I love this live environment. You know, with all this technology, they say that human beings need more connection than ever because we're so, you know, stuck behind our computer screen or iPhones. And I actually just saw a keynote speaker give an incredible talk about how the minute you have a cell phone out on a table, even if you're not looking at it, it actually lowers your intimacy and decreases vulnerability and
what's
your
that
conversation.
All about? It's like just a robot.
Yeah, just on the table. Okay, yeah. So if you want to have better conversations with the people you love or your employees or your coworkers, have your phone in your purse or in your pocket. Do not even show it, and you'll have a better conversation.
You know, I'd spent 4 years doing the Oprah Radio thing with Dr. Oz and the whole crew, and I got a BlackBerry when I came on board there.
Sure.
What
I
a
used
pain
to have
in
a,
the ass.
I used to have a BlackBerry. I loved those things.
Well, they're
I
great until you don't have it, meaning, remember when they would vibrate and you knew everything in the planet was going on funneled through your hip? Literally for 6 months after I got rid of it, my hip would vibrate. There's like a medical condition for
no,
that.
No, what I love is, you know, I was resistant to the iPhone because I loved my BlackBerry so much, right? I just loved my BlackBerry.
Wait. You love your BlackBerry.
I loved my BlackBerry.
Why?
Yeah.
It's an inanimate
object. You know what it is?
Because
I loved that keyboard because I'm a, I can type faster than anybody in there. You know,
is that
every
a fact?
Every time I'm in a cab and I start typing away, the cab driver literally sometimes goes, What is happening?
Thank God for opposable thumbs, huh?
And so when I went to my girlfriend, one of my good friends, Andy Page, she's like, got the iPhone. I'm like, I'm not gonna use that phone. And then she goes, okay, over the weekend.
Is that really how she talks around everything?
No, that's how I talk. I'm not gonna do that.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, over the weekend, she's like, well, let me just show you some things about it, right? And then I'm like, damn, I want that iPhone.
I'm basically a stegosaurus. You know, I have a really decent framework, but my brain, when it comes to technical stuff, outside of a studio, no thanks. And I remember I had this friend of mine who waited in line to get the new iPhone.
I won't do that.
Waited in line.
I won't do it.
$500 off. Would you do it for $500
no,
off?
No, I'm not going to stand in line. Sorry, waited I just
in,
won't.
Waited in line. You know, like people used to do for Beanie Babies, you know, crap like that.
Yeah, I won't do that either.
Not even for a Beanie Baby?
I will not do it.
Okay. So she waited in line for this iPhone, gets to the front of the line.
Nothing's that important to stand in line for.
Come to find out that it was only for new customers.
Yeah,
she waited 3 hours. And I said, didn't it occur to you walking back that there's something wrong with humans waiting in line for just about anything?
Yeah. No, I won't wait in line. I got better things to do. You know what I'm saying?
So I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
All right. We had enough banter out of the way. Let's start digging into the marrow.
Go for it, John.
So all of your work in the world, which we'll get to the life coaching stuff later, but your work in the world, which I think is different than, it's who you are, which is different than what you do. I see there's a separation there, but who you are in the world and the things you bring to the world come out of circumstances that I don't know any other person, I know a lot of humans, have experienced in their lifetime. And the thing that's been fascinating watching you evolve over the years and all your work and who you are is that had that been different, you'd probably been different.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
I think you're supposed to be this person. So I'll let you tell the story of what happened, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I know without a shadow of a doubt, the story I'm about to tell you is what was meant for me in my life. Now, would I change it if I could? Yes. Would I change the outcome? Absolutely. Would I not wish this on anybody? Yes. So even though now, in retrospect, I can see, okay, this is how I've been created and what I'm meant to do, and because of the situation, of course, I wouldn't want it to happen to me or anybody else. And what you're referring to, John, is literally the worst day of my life. When I was 14 years old, it was Father's Day, and you know, like most people on Father's Day, my father was taking us out to Sunday brunch. And I grew up in a little tiny town, you know, Escanaba. I grew up 2.5 hours north of that in Hancock, Michigan, which is about 5,000 people.
The snow capital of the planet.
365 inches of snow a year when I was growing up. Now they have a little less because of global warming.
Right.
But, you know, it was 365 inches a year. It snowed from, you know, what, October to May, right? And so it's a big deal going out to brunch because I don't know about you, but we had 3 girls and 2 parents. That's 5 people. That's a lot of money. And we didn't have that kind of money. So it was a big deal. And so my father comes over. He's taking us to brunch. My sisters are in the bathroom fighting it out. Me and my mom start walking out to the car. My dad's coming with us, too, and he's going to get his coat from the car. And instead of grabbing a coat from the car, John, my father grabbed a gun and he starts screaming at my mother, "You made me do this. You made me do this." And he fires. And I am the only one out there. My sisters are both in the bathroom and I just start screaming, "What are you doing, Dad? What are you doing? Stop." And my father cocks the gun and points the gun at me. And I absolutely, with every fiber of my being, thought I was next. And I think I would have been next, except my mother, with her literal last breath, saw that gun in my face and screamed, "No, don't." And my father, realizing my mother was still alive, took that bullet intended for me and shot my mother a second time. And that second bullet went through my mother's abdomen, out her back, and landed in the car horn. And for the next 20 minutes, all I heard was, and then my father ran right next to me, as close as you are to me, John, just a few feet, and put the gun to his head and fired. So within about 2 minutes, I was the sole witness to my father murdering my mother and committing suicide in front of me. Now, I don't know how anybody else would respond, but this is what I did. I blame myself. I was the only one out there that could have done something, right? I was the only one that could have kicked my father, grabbed the gun, jumped in front of my mother, done something.
And you were 14?
I was 14. And I get, you know, logically,
sure.
As an adult, you can logically go, well, of course you couldn't do anything. Logically, when you're, you know, 20 years later, 30 years later, you get that there was no way I could have probably stopped my father. But when you're 14, you believe you could have. I could have done something. And you know what? I don't care how old you would have been. You probably had that thought too. You could have done something. And I didn't do something because I was frozen in place, just staying stop. And so from that moment on, I basically split myself in two. On one hand, I was still a straight A student, class president, you know, still like, I'm fine. Everything's fine. I'm fine. And if you saw me and met me, you probably thought I was fine because people wanted to believe I was fine, right? They want to believe. I remember when O.J. Simpson, after that scenario, you know, oh, the kids are fine. Well, you want the kids to be fine. Trust me, the kids aren't fine, right? Nobody's fine after this. And so for the next 20 years, I kept myself together during high school. And the minute I went to college at the University of Minnesota, I didn't know anybody. Nobody knew my story. And I started losing it. And really, it started impacting me, being in a big town and not knowing anybody. And I started drinking, became an alcoholic, tried to kill myself three times. And it was that third suicide attempt that I realized that I'm not very good at killing myself. And I got to figure this out because I'm not dying. Because I just wanted to die. Right. But when you try to die and you're not dying... You know, I remember that third time waking up in the psychiatric ward because they do evaluate you after three suicide attempts. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, I'm not dying. I guess I have to live. And if I have to live, I can't keep living like this. I cannot keep living like this. This is not good. I mean, I was ripping apart inside of me. I mean, I would be okay during the day. And, you know, if again, you would have met me, I would have kind of kept it together and been like smiley and cheery. And, but inside, and, you know, now I think that most people live like I lived those 20 years, you know, on the outside, they're saying, yeah, I'm fine. I'm great. I go to work. I got my husband, got my wife, got my partner, got my mate, got my, you know, and got my kids. And I got to my thing. And they're doing, you know, they're running, they're doing the best they can. Right. But inside, in the middle of the night, right? In the middle of the night, you look yourself in the face in the mirror, or you're just lying in bed next to your mate who's snoring or sleeping, and you go, is this it? What the heck is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? Why can't I get it together? Why can't I change my life? Why am I stuck in this place? And that's how I felt. I felt for 20 years, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And, you know, trust me, I read the books. I went to the workshops. I did a lot of things to try to change myself. I'm proactive. I was like, I got to get help. But none of those things, they gave me skills, they gave me tools, but nothing changed how I felt about myself.
So here's a couple things. First of all, this is all very surreal to me. I remember, I'm looking at your first book, Fearless Living. I'm remembering a conversation from 15, 18 years ago, whatever it is. And the same energy, drive, intensity I heard then, still there now, number one. Number two, I never give anybody that much time on the microphone, sister. Well done. And and they say 80% of our communication is nonverbal. Mm-hmm. And I've watched, in the last 3 minutes, I watched your body go through all these emaciations. And I was watching your fingers. And as soon as you did that horn sound, you closed your eyes. And I thought, you know, most people don't have that to push off away from. Most people don't experience that. And so there's a gap between what happens to us and what we perceive happens to us and how we deal with what happens to us. And my little adage was like, you know, things happen to you or they go through you. And so if they happen to you, maybe you never get them off. If they go through you, then they become fodder for something else. You know, this show is going to air in a couple of weeks and it'll be repeated at some point, but it's just before spring where people start planting.
Yes.
And we spend about $1 billion every year on bags of shit.
Yes.
Manure.
That's
because
right.
Shit
that's
makes
right.
stuff grow.
That's right. My brother-in-law sells shit.
Does he?
Yes,
he's
he
a
does.
Shit seller.
Yeah,
is he?
He's a shit seller.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I hope he's doing well.
Well, he works for one of the largest companies in America.
A big shit seller.
He does tankers. Like he gets shit from other countries.
Tankers of
he
shit.
He buys so much shit, he gets it from all over the world.
It's nice to know.
And he buys tankers
of
shit.
It's nice to know that somewhere there's tankers of shit.
No, there are tankers of shit, and he like is up all night waiting for his tank to get in.
Learning something new every day on the air here, kids.
Isn't it crazy?
But again, this is the setup that says this is an experience that you had and that you transcend it and you get pulled back. I always feel like a rubber band. Sometimes we go through stuff, get pulled
yes.
back, learn it again. And the break point, suicides, alcoholism, everything that you just talked
nightmares
about.
Nightmares every night for 14 years.
All this. Where's the break point? What was the leverage point finally that said enough?
Well, there was a few things. One was the suicide for definite because That third suicide, I literally thought I was, I mean, come on, three times, come on, come on, right? Come on. And so when I woke up.
Did you feel like you were failing even at that?
I say I need a coach to commit suicide. God. Like I need a suicide coach, right? And sadly, there are those things, people, now. That's what's sad about it. But you know, when I didn't die that time, I really had to sit myself down and say, there's something bigger here. There's something here, because I don't think I'm meant to die. If you try three times and you don't die, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, I believe that there's something more out there. And I want to believe that there's something bigger than me that loves me, right? I want to believe that. So I was like, okay, maybe there's something bigger that does love me, and there's something I'm supposed to do with this. Now, again, that was just kind of a little teeny tiny thought, right? It wasn't a thought that I acted on.
It wasn't
just
the clouds parting
No. It was just, I had that experience. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But, you know, the third suicide was huge. The second big thing that happened was getting sober. You know, when I got sober, I had to feel. Like, really feel, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a lot of feelings before, because obviously I was going through this stuff. So I felt a lot, but I couldn't process it properly because I was drinking. So getting sober was critical for me to tell myself the truth. So I had to get sober. I do not know how people have intimate relationships and drink. I just don't get it. I don't get it, because how... I don't get it. So... And the third thing was when I forgave my father. And those things happened really quickly together. Mm-hmm. It was boom, 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 right?
Mm-hmm. And trifecta.
Yeah, it was a trifecta. And my father, so it was my nightmares. I quit drinking and had those nightmares. Because remember, I had nightmares every night for 14 years. And so I was... You know, before to go to sleep, I either had a drink, I had to sleep with the light on, or I had to sleep with somebody. You know mm-hmm, what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so now I'm sober. My boyfriend just broke up with me. And I had a car accident that my face was smashed up. So there was no sleeping with anybody, and there was no drinking. And mind you, I've been sober for 2 months, and I had a car accident and smashed my face, and I'm home alone. Not a good place for a recovering alcoholic who's just 2 months sober, right? And, so my father's in my closet like he always is, and I couldn't take it anymore because I just wanted to sleep. And so I literally yelled at my father, why are you here? Can't you leave me alone? Why are you here? And I remember just being so exasperated, like, why can't you leave me alone? And a thought went through my mind that had never gone through my mind before. It's a crazy thought. And how I interpret it is even crazier. But the thought I had was, if you can't beat them, join them. That's the thought that went through my brain. And how I interpreted in that moment of being so angry at my father for haunting me is I said, okay, Dad, okay, if I can't beat them, join them. Okay. Dad, come on over here. Come on over here, Dad. And my dad comes over. And now, mind you, I don't see him, but I just know he's there. And I hug him. And I whisper in his ear, I forgive you. And he whispers in mine, that's what I've been waiting for.
All this time.
Yes. So I cry myself to sleep. I go to bed, fall asleep, have the same nightmare. Father chasing me through the woods, bullets flying, trying to kill me. Same dream. But this time I turn around and I say, go ahead and kill me. And I spread my arms open and I just say, do it. So my father starts shooting me and it misses. And he loads the gun again, and he shoots at me, and he misses. And he is perplexed because I'm standing still, and just go ahead, shoot me. He tries one more time. Doesn't hit me. Puts the gun down. He says, well, I guess that's over. He grabs a picnic basket from behind a wall, a stone wall, pulls it out and says, do you want to have a picnic? I said, yeah. Yes, Dad. He pulls out a picnic, red and white checkered blanket. We sit underneath a tree and break bread together. And I've never had a nightmare since.
Rhonda Britton is in the studio with me. Aren't you glad? I am. Because this is the kind of stuff that I'm talking about. And I beat into the ground for 20 years. Forever. And it's a, and the reason I call it this show Life Matters is A, this is about things that really matter in life, because the rest of the shit you can't do a hell of a lot anyway. We
That's
spend
right.
time there. But what these three things you're talking about, forgiveness, alcohol, and suicide, all the string that runs through all those.
Yeah.
As in the 21st century, I don't know, as humans, we're wired for all the stress that comes our way.
We're not, by the way.
We're not physically wired for it.
The brain and body, the neurobiology of who we are, is not wired for this level of activity.
Which we've created, by the way.
Yes, that's right. But we're not meant to have this much stimulus during the day.
Mm-hmm.
We're literally not wired for this.
I have this weird theory. I don't know what we're morphing into, but it's not who we used to be.
No, absolutely not. Because, I mean, just watch the children, right? Mm-hmm. What they're capable of. They're coming out of the womb practically, you knowing how to use an iPhone. I mean, it's just
shocking. I wonder who taught them that, Rhonda. Must have been you. We're going to take a short time out. Take care of the people that take care of us.
You're listening to Life Matters with John St. Augustine.
I have been saying, and we're back, for like 20 some odd years. I don't actually go anywhere. I just like to say it. It is so rare for me to have a human being in the studio. Someone I have a great admiration for and respect for. Going on 2 decades, Rhonda Britton is here. Numerous books that she's put out, bestsellers, television. We walk in to CBS on the 10th floor, and a former coworker of mine, somebody I'd hired when I was at Harpo, Rhonda Britton. Like, how do you know? You know,
600 episodes of television is how she knows me.
It's like,
Emmy Award, 4 books, Fearless Living, Change Your Life in 30 Days, and Do I Look Fat in This?
I'm like, can I carry your coat? Is that all right?
No, you can't, John.
I'm sorry. You're not worthy. So let's dig into a couple things. Number one is, I'm going to try and work backwards on this. We'll do this for maybe about 14, 15 more minutes, taking a little break. I want to stay fresh on this forgiveness thing.
Mm-hmm. Critical.
Yes, it
you
seems to
me. You can't move on. You got to do it.
Right.
You got to do it.
And no matter what it is.
You got to do it.
So I say, when you turn on the television and you hear people on TV, shows that you're not on, going, I'll never forgive that SOB. What do you say? Whatever.
Well, if you don't forgive, you are the one that your life will be cut off, cut short, cut out. Because when you don't forgive, you literally have to hide a piece of your heart. You literally have to knock down some cells. You literally have to lie to yourself. So forgiveness is a critical component of your capacity to love, to have intimacy, vulnerability, to have connection with others. So if, and oh, by the way, if you can't forgive another human being, you're definitely not going to be able to forgive yourself. So everybody, we've all done things we're not proud of. When I was an alcoholic, I've done horrible things to other human beings I'm not proud of.
You could probably get a reality show now being that person easier than being you now.
Oh, no.
Right?
Yeah, like people have said to me, well, God, we want to follow you around. I'm like, my life is really even keel. It's not that exciting because, you know, I mean, it's exciting to me, but I'm centered, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Certain peace of mind and a certain, right? But forgiveness is so critical. Yeah, they would have loved to follow me around when
I was
younger, right? But, you know, the level of self-destruction you have to do to keep that anger simmering, to be unforgiving, costs you your ability to love, to be the light that you're meant to be. It causes you so much suffering and pain. So your most courageous step, one of the most courageous steps I did, was not only forgiving my father. By the way, John, forgiving my father was the easiest person to forgive. Forgiving my mother, because in order to even admit that I needed to forgive my mother, I had to take her off the pedestal. I had to take her off and say, okay, Mom, yes, you were murdered, because, you know, she's the victim.
Yeah.
So I got to keep her on the pedestal to make, you know, like, Mother, you're the innocent victim, right? I had to take her off the pedestal and go, Mom, how did you contribute to all this? Now, wait, did my mother cause her own death? Of course not. That's not what I'm saying. But she stayed with my father for 20 years, right? And I could go into a whole bunch of things, but...
So it wasn't while the outcome was maybe not inevitable, it was definitely assured in some way because of the dynamics.
It wasn't assured, I wouldn't even say that, but what I would say is that it was a possibility, you know? But even but back then, remember, domestic violence wasn't talked about. That was not in our heads one bit, right? We weren't thinking anything bad was going to happen.
Right.
I mean, my father didn't, you know, beat my mother on a regular basis. He was definitely emotionally abusive. He tried to strangle me when I was 12. But again, that's not even in our mindset, domestic violence back then. It just wasn't even And sadly, it's still not in people's mind today. So forgiving my mother, I had to take her off the pedestal. I had to be like, okay, Mom, you're a woman, you're a human being, and you stayed with Dad even though this, and this. And he, you know, when he strangled me when I was 12, you didn't take me out of the house and you didn't kick him out. Right? Like you like made that okay. Mm-hmm, nobody talked mm-hmm. about it. So taking her off the pedestal, whew, that was harder to forgive. Because again, remember, I didn't even think I had to forgive her. So even admitting I had to forgive her was the big deal. Then lastly, forgiving myself. Forgiving myself for what I did to myself afterwards. Forgiving myself for the pain I put myself through. Forgiving myself for not saving them. Forgiving myself for how I act. I mean, just the whole before, during, and after, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. forgiving myself was the hardest. And, you know, I write a lot about this in my book, Fearless Living, because I did a huge ceremony on the 20th anniversary of my parents' death. I did not forgive myself until it was 20 years later, because until then, I didn't have a right to be happy. See, when you witness your parents' murder-suicide, you shouldn't be happy.
Sure.
I mean,
right.
Like, what,
it's not
to,
a party.
You're supposed to laugh
right.
after
right.
that?
Right.
What, you're supposed to be okay?
Mm-hmm.
No. So I think so many people don't allow themselves to be happy like I didn't. And their life isn't about murder-suicide, but it's something else. Their parents got divorced. Their husband left them. Their wife cheated on them. You know, their child doesn't love them. So they don't even give themselves permission to be happy. I didn't give myself permission to be happy for 20 years. And the day, the 20th anniversary of their death, I said no more. No more. No more. No more. No more. No. No more. I've given them 20 years. They died when I was 14. So I've given them almost a third more.
A third more.
So I finally did. It took me an entire day. I went through an entire, mm-hmm. I made up this whole ceremony. I talk about it in detail in Fearless mm-hmm. Living. And when I walked away, when I turned away, because I did it at a lake, when I turned away from that lake and started walking towards my car, I had never walked in steps that were just mine. I could feel me occupying my body for probably the first time in my life. It was mind-blowing. It was like I was here.
You arrived.
I arrived.
The concept of forgiveness is a very large umbrella.
Yes.
You can go to church and get in line and go kneel and talk to someone. You can go to therapy. You can go to groups.
Sure. Tell a friend.
How do you give me a nuts and bolts thing? You did your ceremony. I know that there's not one right answer for everybody. Is it the, how do I say this?
It's the willingness.
What's the payoff in not doing it? Let's work backwards. Why would we people hold on to shit for years?
So
what's
we can
the payoff?
Keep that, so we can stay angry, so we can feel righteous. So
feel
we can
righteous.
So we can mm-hmm. feel righteous, so that we can feel right, that we can say we were smarter, we were better, we were something more. And as long as I don't forgive, then you're wrong and I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also people are deathly afraid of forgiving because they think that then they're like, if I forgive you, that means you're going to hurt me again. Okay. So a lot of people have tied up in forgiveness that if I forgive you, that I'm holding my boundaries and I'm being tough and you can't hurt me anymore. Right? So I have to stay angry to protect myself.
But while inflicting
pain on
yourself. Right.
But I would say most people that I work with and I've seen, a part of them keeping the anger is a right to have a boundary. They don't feel like they have a right to have a boundary and say no to that person if they're not angry. So if they don't have that anger, then I'm supposed to have lunch with you, or I'm supposed to be friends with you again, or I'm supposed to let you treat me the way you treat me. No, you don't have to stay angry. You can just say no, thank you. Right?
Yeah, it doesn't mean you're going dancing Friday.
I'm not going dancing with you.
Yeah.
And you know what? You're never coming over my house again, but I don't have to spit your name out every
day. You're like, you've cut the toxic umbilical cord,
that's
as it
right.
were. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk with Rhonda Britton. Talk with Rhonda Britton. I never talk to her. I always talk with her because I learned a long time ago. Anyway, we're all these concepts that go into us being human, and there's an evolutionary process. And, you know, we could spend hours doing this, maybe a whole week of shows. Don't have that kind of time today. So I have so much going through my mind. The thing that comes up over and over again as you're speaking, and I knew you were going to be in here today, was this evolutionary concept. Something happens in our lives.
Yes.
If we don't get it, other things keep happening, it seems, till we get it.
That's
You're
right.
on board with that.
Yes. And I think you also don't have to go in the past and dig. So this is my how I work is I do not do work on my clients and go, let's talk about the past.
Hold on 1 second. Everybody listen. Go.
Never. I'm not interested in talking about the past. What I am interested in is helping you move forward. Now, this is what happens, John. as my clients move forward, my private clients, I train coaches, workshops, courses. As we start moving forward, I want to become more loving. I want to become more successful. I want to be whatever you want. That next thing you want is why you come to me, right? As we start moving towards that, you know what comes up? The past. And then we deal with it, right? Then we deal with it. So I don't go digging.
Right. It just shows up.
It shows up. You tell me you want to find love. You want me to help you find a mate, or you want me to help you triple your income? Oh, honey, as we triple your income, every time you have felt unsuccessful, every time, you know, that is going to come up because it has to in order to be moved through and healed so you can triple your income.
Yes, you're right. That was that was bam.
Yeah, well it's true. It's like I feel so passionate about it because people are told, this is what people think. If I just found the key of why I'm like this, if I just found the story, what happened to me when I was 2, 5, 8? What is that magic key? Trust me, there are so many things that happened to you when you were younger. There is no one. But this is also what's really important, John, is that science has now proven, okay? I've been talking about this for a year, but now the study has come out, which I love, that proves that some of your basic fears in life, the same things that drive you, that the avoidances you have, actually are in your DNA handed down through your line.
Absolutely.
So the things that you think, if I just found that reason why I just have a difficult time with men, it must be my father did something. Or if I just understood why, then if I could just find that moment and then heal that, then I'd be... No, honey, it could be your great-great-grandfather. So you may never find the moment. Yeah. So move forward. The moment that has to be healed will come up to be healed. You don't have to go looking for it. You don't have to look.
It always shows itself.
It shows
I was
itself.
In a lumber store yesterday doing manly things.
Oh, I love that.
I know you do.
Do you have a tool belt? Because don't be talking to me.
I'm a single woman, John.
I'm a single woman.
Hubba, hubba, hubba.
Yeah, don't be talking to me about tool belts.
So I had a 12-footer that I had to get cut in half to 6 feet.
Of course you did.
Yes. I had to say that. And I went to find the guy to cut it. And of course, as I was...
But you could if you wanted to.
If I wanted to cut it myself.
You could cut it yourself.
I could peel it right back.
Yeah, because you're from Michigan.
That's right. And that's what we do there. We cut wood in half.
Well, we also can do pretty much anything, can
we,
John?
That's exactly right. You know, it's interesting.
We're resilient.
There hasn't been a Wolverine in the Wolverine state in 130 years. They should change it to something else.
Come on. We need it for the Lake Superior.
Like a cow. Because
I was born in...
No, just change the name.
I was born in the mouth of the wolf.
Living, drinking around Lake Superior, weren't you?
That's right.
We get our water. We break the ice and get our bathing water. So anyway, I'm in the store yesterday getting this wood cut in half, and I caught a big sliver in the palm of my hand, and it hurts.
Yeah, sure does.
It hurts going in, but not as much as comes out.
That's right.
And I started thinking about when I do my little projects and stuff. I talk the same thing. It's a different language for this, you know, the knuckle dragging Stegosaurus guys. But these splinters go into us, but they may be splinters from, as you pointed out, the
years.
Homeland.
Yeah, that's right. It might be, three generations back.
When it pops up, we got a choice, though, is what I think you teach the best. You have a choice. Pull it out or push it in.
Or leave it there oozing.
Yes.
Right? Like it's just sitting there and you keep on hitting it, keep on hitting it, keep on hitting it, keep on hitting it.
Yeah,
right?
Do the woulda, coulda, shoulda shuffle. There you go.
I wish. Hope.
You've made I don't want to say a living because you already were living before this, but you've made a presence, in my opinion, around the concept of fear, what it is and what it isn't, how it moves you, how it moves people, how it holds people back. It'd be too simple to say, how do you define fear? Because I think we each have something in our own that scares us for some shape. For me, it's like the movie Night of the Living Dead. Mm-hmm. You ever seen this?
No, I have not. I don't watch scary movies for obvious reasons.
Yeah, well, it's probably a good idea. We go to the drive-in theater in 1968. I'm 10 years old. Me and my buddy Vinnie Connor, we're sitting in front of the car.
Oh,
the
boy.
Zombies start coming up. My dad hits the horn up in the air in orbit. Ever since then, no thanks.
Yeah.
And it's a weird splinter for me. So you look at all the little things that pop up for people that we'd rather not deal with and that kind of thing. But your work with people, your living with people, your presence with people, as we said before, we're being squeezed. They always say if you squeeze oranges, you get orange juice. You squeeze people, all kind of shit comes out. And we're getting squeezed.
That's right.
When that happens and you're dealing with people and you're working with them one-on-one, how long does it typically take if there is a typical time for them to go, oh, I get it? Is it when that splinter pops up or that break comes, wow?
I mean, I teach something called the Fearless Foundation Workshop. It's a 3-day event, right?
Why don't you just plug that?
Why, thank you.
Oh, go ahead.
Fearless Foundation Workshop. You can find everything at fearlessliving.org. Fearless Living Foundation Workshop. That 3 days is when, because I have a theory on fear, like you said, and I believe that we all have one core trigger fear that creates a lot of fear responses.
Okay.
So people think they, you know, people don't usually talk about I'm afraid or I'm scared. That's what people, most of us don't walk around saying I'm afraid, I'm scared. We just don't. But we do walk around saying I'm worried or I feel guilty or I feel ashamed or I'm embarrassed, right? We do talk about those
versions
things.
Of fear.
Yeah, versions of fear. That's right. So you can't be worried unless there's a driving fear underneath. You can't be a procrastinator unless there's a driving fear underneath. You can't be a perfectionist if there's not a driving fear underneath. You can't feel overwhelmed unless there's a driving fear underneath. So what I do, my work is to tell you show you what the driving fear is underneath, because I believe that each of us has a unique thing that's driving us. So, you know, in that Fearless Foundation workshop, what we do is I help you discover, and we do it in those 3 days, what your individual unique wheel of fear is, what your trigger is, how your fear responses are, what your core negative. And then more importantly, I help you discover what your wheel of freedom is, how you move from fear no matter where you are. So the minute you're worried, you know what to do. The minute you procrastinate, you know what to do. The minute you're perfectionist, you know what to do. So there's no stuck anymore, right? There's no stuck.
Is fear learned behavior to some degree because it repeats itself?
Well, it's a neurobiology. It's part of our system. It's part of the amygdala, right? So it is...
Ooh, say amygdala again.
Amygdala.
Oh, I like
and
that.
Hippocampus.
Oh, I always like Abdullah Ablangana. So we have these fears that are part of our rudder. It steers us to a certain degree. It becomes habits we take on.
Well, because we don't know any better.
Right.
No one's taught this stuff. Like, I was never taught about fear growing up. And 99.999% of speakers and books just go, don't be afraid, right? So... nobody really, I don't know anybody that talks about fear like I do. And I think it's because I'm not afraid of fear. I love fear. And I think fear loves us.
Can fear, I'm glad you said that, because this is what we call a segue into the next thing, tied to one thing in front of it. Can fear be a good thing moving us forward in life? Can it be, are there healthy fears not to be afraid of? I mean, look. What's the number? People are afraid to go swimming because of a shark attack, but bees kill more people. So that's irrational fear. But can fear be something that moves us in a way that actually was
absolutely,
good?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, fear is one of our greatest assets. And we can talk about that after the break if you want.
I love someone who knows their way around a microphone. John St. Augustine, Rhonda Britton in the studio with me. Back with more right after this.
You're listening to Life Matters with John St. Augustine.
There's been some editing in the show. I don't know where it's at yet, but it's going to be really interesting how this all turns out. Because as you're speaking, Rhonda Britton's in the studio with me. I'm already envisioning getting emails and things on Facebook and people responding. Why are you looking at me like that?
I'm looking. I'm just listening intently. This is what human interaction's like, John.
Go ahead.
I'm just listening.
Because I'm normally in here alone.
I know. I'm listening.
And you know what? 100 years ago, if you get in a room with glass and talk alone, they lock you up for a long time. So here they let me do this. But... I already know, I can tell by this conversation that the ripple effect from this for people, profound. Because there isn't anybody listening, Democrat, Republican, or other, man, woman, or child, doesn't matter what color you are, we all have these.
We all have fear.
It's our blueprint and our wiring.
We all have fear. There is no getting around it. So if you ever see a flyer or a book that says, get rid of your fear and never be afraid again. This is what you say to them. Why are you going to give me a lobotomy? Because it's in our neurobiology. So I'm not talking about getting rid of fear. I'm talking about mastering fear. I'm not talking about managing fear, because I don't want you to manage your stress or manage your fear. That's baloney paloney. I want you to become masterful. I want you to know what to do when fear comes up.
Do you think most of our emotions and things are driving us, or we're driving them? Are we run more from our internal unconscious as humans, or...
Yeah, I mean, the thing that we have is we have something called the frontal lobe, right? It's in front of our brain, right? The amygdala is in the back of our brain. And it's called, also another name for it is the primitive brain. And the amygdala doesn't know the difference. The brain doesn't know the difference between an imagined event or a real event. So something happens.
So that's why I go to see Night of Living Dead. It's not real.
Yeah.
And 50 years later, my palms sweat.
Well, yeah, but, you know, for me, I don't go to movies like that because I witnessed it and I relive it, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is that we are run by our unconsciousness, our fears, unconscious fears, unless we see them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the thing. Fear is as smart as you are, as educated as you are, as spiritual as you are. It's insidious, it is tricky, and it is invisible. So unless you use your frontal lobe... to learn and become aware and see it, you just think you have bad behavior.
Agreed.
You just are not proud of yourself.
It's just the way I am.
You're just the way I am. Yeah. I mean, look at reality television. This scares me. Talk about scared. The fact that people, like I know grown women and grown men that watch the Housewives shows, you know? And again, okay, I understand. And I ask them every time they say, oh my God, it's my favorite show. I go, what's so great about the show? I just think it's so funny. Not funny. Not funny watching grown women attack each other. Not funny. Not. I don't find that funny. I find that so horrific. And you're educating your children and you are laughing at that. And that is the reason. And we accept that. And we think that's funny. Mm-hmm. And we think, oh, and they're arguing grown women. They've made it acceptable to have that bad behavior.
We have moved the edge of reality, which is a perception,
that's
as
right.
you point out, to
that's
the
right.
point where we don't know which is which.
That's right.
So before we get on to presidential politics and fear, I want to rewind just a second back to what you're talking about. The things that, like this, we're teaching our kids what to watch and what we see and how
yes.
to support. And whenever I ask somebody about those shows, they say, well, it makes me feel better that my life's not so bad. And I'm thinking,
oh,
if that's the measuring stick
yeah,
that
yeah,
you're
but
using.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, right. that saddens me so much. That deeply saddens me, because if you have to look at something worse than you to make yourself feel good, that tells me how much suffering and pain you're in,
yeah.
and how you are so not proud of who you are, and mm-hmm. and really don't see your own light and your own brilliance. So that deeply saddens me, and I have a deep appreciation of what it takes to be a human being, and I have deep compassion for the difficulties we all go through, because I think it is difficult, you know, just like you know, Scott Peck said years ago, you know, life is hard.
Listen,
right?
This is perfect, because I say that to people and they're like, well, what do you mean? It's because we think it should be different. Just because we think it should be different, it should be easy because we watch television. It wasn't hard growing up, whatever it may be. And then we run into these difficulties. We don't know we have the tools to deal with them.
Right. But we've never been taught the tools.
Correct.
Right. We don't know the tools. So we just avoid the difficulties and do the easy thing, i.e. drink, avoid,
right,
watch
right.
TV, and that becomes the easy thing, right? And everybody
else,
right, we think. And all of our friends do it, so we hang out with friends. Like my friends, nobody like watches TV, nobody
right,
drinks.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, like you hang around the same type of people. If you want to know who you are, just look at your friends.
My mom used to say, birds of a feather flock together.
That's right.
And if you don't like the flock you're in, tell them to flock off. That's my part. She would never say that. But there are a lot of people. This fear factor seems
yes.
to be like a virus,
yes.
Rhonda.
Yes. Yeah.
And let me just say this before you jump on that. I don't think much of Donald Trump one way or the other. I think sometimes teachers show up and show us who we are and who we're not, what we have, what we don't have. And if nothing else, this guy is saying, I fooled y'all. Because I can't really possibly do any of these things I'm telling you. But
yes.
you don't really don't care. You just want me to hear me say it.
Yeah.
And
well,
for us,
yes.
we think that's enough.
And where I bring in the whole reality television thing, because I truly believe that Donald Trump would not be where he is today if there was not reality television.
Did you know that he was on the cover of Playboy once?
Honey, he's been divorced twice.
But I'm saying in general, when you look at what he's built to get to this point, it's almost like evolutionary that he had tried it. He tried to run it once before. He got out and said, it's way too tough. I didn't think they'd be this difficult.
Right,
well,
but then he figured it out. Right, but he also, there's a whole thing going around on Facebook that I can't remember, it was 1977 or something. He says, if I ever ran for president, I'd run as a Republican because they believe anything. You know?
Well, it turned out that wasn't true.
Oh, it did?
People Magazine? Yeah, it never happened.
I don't know if it was in People Magazine.
Do you
magazine.
Know Snope?
Yeah,
Snope's
I do.
Best
I
thing
do.
In the world.
I do.
I saw a picture today, a guy that I know very well, put a picture of Hillary Clinton shaking hands with Osama bin Laden. And said, when you get ready to vote, remember this photo. Well, it's not true. It's doctored.
It's unbelievable that people spend time.
But isn't that true, though, what you're saying?
So
that it doesn't matter if it's real or not? Look at this. No matter what it is.
No, I mean, my sister is voting for Trump. And so I said to her, okay, so tell me, you know, why you're voting for Trump. Well, because he's going to shake things up. I go, have you listened to every single debate, because I'm, you know, that's who I am. So I'm listening to every debate. I go, have you listened to any of the debates? Because I listen to Republican and Democrat. She goes, no, I don't need to listen. I'm just going to vote for him because he's a mover and a shaker and he's going to change things. I go, Cindy, do you understand how he talks to women? Do you understand what he thinks of women? Do you understand what he thinks of minorities? Do you understand how he talks just to regular people? And how he is literally a bully and abusive. And I'm not saying that because I don't like him. I'm saying it because if you didn't if you didn't see a picture of him and you just listened to the words, and he wasn't running for president, and you literally just took his face out and maybe even changed the voice, but the words were coming out, you would say he's a bully and he's an abuser. And if you knew about narcissists or any of those things, you would say that as mm-hmm, well. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, a gaslighter, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not, I'm not even talking his politics.
Correct.
It's not Republican, Democrat. Right, that's irrelevant to me. I'm talking about his behavior. Mm-hmm. And that's why when you laugh.
And her response was?
Oh, no, she's like,
doesn't matter. So they don't despise me. Remember when the guy at the Philadelphia Eagles slugged his girlfriend in the elevator?
Yeah.
And people on the Eagles fans said, well, it's okay.
Well, right, because we want him to play.
Because he's our guy. Right.
Because we want him to play.
Is this not the same thing?
Yeah. It's the level that you're willing to change your morals, you're willing to change your values, you're willing to change your ethics in order to win, in order to be right. Again, going back to that right, going to be right and win, you know, then it's okay, right? We'll just brush it under the rug, you know? Mm-hmm. And the fact is again, our president, we want him to be a moral, upstanding human being is what we want. But I do believe that because we have been watching so much reality television, there's such an inundation of reality television that, and the bad behavior is praised, right? Bad behavior is what
and
we're
rewarded.
Laughing at. Rewarded and
big
what we're
money.
Laughing at,
yeah.
right? We're
yeah.
laughing at it and yes, they get paid. I mean, I changed lives on TV, 600 episodes and I got paid, you know, 1/100th of
right.
what they're getting paid now.
Right.
If they behave poorly, they get paid more than me.
If you take your teeth out and gain 60 pounds and walk backwards, you're in.
You're in. Right. Yeah. If I want to make money, I wouldn't be doing what I do today. That's for sure.
Speaking of that, let's get ready to kind of put this last piece in place. I have a difficult time. I mean, we all have our challenges.
We all do.
And we have all had our experiences. And some are, you know, I don't have the experience you have.
I'm
and
glad.
You don't have the experience that I have. And
yes.
I don't know what it's like. I spoke about 6 months ago, maybe a little bit longer than that. And it was a room. I realized quickly everybody in the room was either a survivor of the Holocaust or the son or daughter of one.
Mm.
What the hell am I going to say to you people?
Yes.
Right? Except
love.
Reverence, right?
Love, reverence,
so all
compassion.
These experiences we have give us the actions we take. And that's comes from experience. More and more, you can go online, $299 bucks. Rhonda, you know what I'm saying? $299 bucks.
Become a life coach?
Right out of the gate.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
Oh, yes. Okay, so I'm just going to, for a minute, talk about the real estate business. Or acting business, either one. We can talk about both of them. Real estate agents. 75% of real estate agents are mediocre at best. 20%, good. They're good. They're good at real estate agents. 5%, top of the game. Same thing with actors. You can talk to any actor. 60, 70, 75%, mediocre at best. 20% working really good actors. And then 5%, boom, stars, top of the game. Same thing with life coaches. 75% to 80% mediocre at best. They know how to ask you the 10 questions they learned in their weekend program. They don't know what it actually means. They don't know the mindset it takes, and they don't really have the foundation, at least. I call it underdeveloped coaching. But they learn the 10 questions. So if you've never done anything in your entire life with personal development, and somebody asks you these 10 questions, John, you're going to be like, oh my God, this is brilliant. And you know what? That coach is going to change your life for those 10 questions.
Yes.
And that might be 10 sessions. That might be 3 sessions. But you're going to be like, wow, right? But that's all the 10 questions they got. That's all they got.
Right.
They got
right,
their
10 right,
questions.
Right, right.
That's it. That's all they got. Because that's all they got on the weekend program that
$299.
They took. $299. That's right. But the problem is that the coaching industry itself, people are signing up for these programs because they're told this is what they need. It's not what you need. You cannot become a good coach in the 20%, a good solid coach, and even aspire to be 5%, which is the best coaches, maybe 50 of us. There's over 850 coaching schools right now. There's only 5 good coaching schools. 5 good coaching schools out of 850. 5. The number one criteria has to be, is it a year-long program? If it's less than a year, forget it. 2 criteria. You must have a single one-on-one mentoring. Do you know that we're the only program in the world, John? Listen to this. That 1 pays their mentors, but 2 trains their mentors in the program. and assigns mentors. So we're the only program that I know of in the entire world that actually pays their mentors, assign their mentors, and trains their mentors. Other people that have mentoring programs either do group mentoring, which doesn't work, by the way. It's not one-on-one. You need one-on-one. Or they say, go and get a mentor, which then you can hire any coach and they're supposed to be your mentor. Well, that's not mentoring. That's just somebody else, some other bad underdeveloped coach training you. So 99% of coaches are underdeveloped. There's only 5 good schools. And so the sad thing is that people who are taking this don't know it. And people who are looking for a coach don't know it. So don't get me started on this, because there are so there's so few good coaching schools, and there's so good few coaches that
it kind of paints a name across. So why do we need this now? Here's my question. My grandmother was a life coach, mostly with mashed potatoes and gravy and a spoon in her hand. And I go back to the days of old, the old dead white guys of the Abe Lincolns and the Teddy Roosevelts, all these guys that had to deal with stuff, and there was no life coaching then. What has shifted in our culture and who we are as a human that we need this now?
I'll tell you. One is that there's a lot of people that have had bad experiences with therapists. And therapists, for some people, is beyond their comprehension. They won't go because it means that I have to get fixed. Coaching isn't about, quote unquote, getting fixed. It's about moving forward. It's about going for your dreams. So therapists are thought of as fixable, and they have to fix you. And coaching is about moving forward and making your dreams happen. That's the difference. So please go to a coach that is credentialed at Fearless Living Institute. You'll know you'll get a good one.
Listen, it has been, I mean, a stellar afternoon having you in here.
Thank you.
It has. You know, I've watched your stuff for years.
Thank you.
And I see the impact you have in people's lives. And once again, I go back and say, had it been different, you'd been different.
Yes.
The fact that you get that and you accept that, I think, makes you more powerful than just saying, you know, it's okay, you can move forward no matter what happens in your life. You come from a place that very few people have come from and survived. I believe that.
Thank you.
And whatever that bigger thing is that nudges us and says, do this, I think it's the same thing that said, go check Facebook, which I don't like spending time in there. It's like an electronic landfill. All kind of shit in there. I get scared in there. But when I saw you pop up, like, this could happen. And so to me, I look at this as part of that
synchronicity.
Chain. I do. Yeah. And I think that whether it's one person or 1,000 or 10,000, when they get this, it's going to be at the right time and the right way for the right reasons.
Right
then. So I appreciate you taking the time today to come and do this.
It has been a blessing. And the one thing I want to leave with everyone is there's nothing wrong with you. It's just fear. There's nothing wrong with you. There is nothing wrong with you. It's just fear. So don't believe fear. There's something larger for you, and you can go for it, and you can be the person you were born to be. You can live the life your soul intended. So it's not you, it's fear. Don't listen.
Even though it's been 3 years since that show originally aired, the messages in there are absolutely timeless, because life in itself and all the challenges and changes we face really is nothing but a giant recycle bin. What goes around comes around. What goes around comes around. What comes around goes around. We go through this stuff over and over again. And I think the great challenge is to see it different every time we go through it. And one of the things Rhonda Britton has become a master at is reframing experience, because there are people that have had far less happen to them and have become far worse people. And there are people that have had far worse happen to them and become fantastic people. So it's really about reframing the experience. Humans, among all creatures on the planet, have one, well, we got a few things going for us. We don't use them all the time. But one thing is for sure, we have the ability to decide what something means. We have the choice to decide what something means, what we assign meaning to, whether it's good or bad, right or wrong, up or down. And what, you know, bothers some people doesn't bother somebody else, and vice versa. But we have that ability. And so after years of struggle, Rhonda was able to reframe it and have it mean something different. And because she did that, she becomes this internationally known advocate for personal change. And I've never had a real comfortable relationship with life coaches. The whole concept, much like everything else humans do, it became so commercialized. Makes no sense to me that you could be, you know, 24, 25, 26 years old. And I've had this happen. After I did my last TED Talk in Canada, I got an email from a young lady who was just enthralled with what I had to say, and she just was over the top, and that's all well and good. And then she said, you know, because of you, I think I'm going to become a life coach. And we had this dialogue back and forth about that. And I said, well, why do you want to be a life coach? I mean, how old are you? Well, I'm 24. okay, well, I have shoes older than that, so how do you become a life coach at 24? Well, you get certified. You get a certification. What does that cost you? $499. But that's not a big deal because I can charge, you know, like $100 an hour. Let me get this straight. You're 24. Your life experience is not a whole lot. You can take a certification, get something to hang on the wall, and then have people pay you to tell them what they probably already know but won't do. And that's the reason you want to do this? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, if that's all you got out of my talk, I think I failed. I'd never really heard from her after that again. Rhonda Britton, however, lives this stuff. Her certification comes from that horrible moment when she was just 14 years old. See, that's a different deal. And the people that have made the most impact in the world, at least in the ones at my observation, their certification is not a piece of paper hanging on the wall. It's something that's inside their soul and something inside their spirit. And that's the ones who make the most difference. Thanks for listening. Thanks for plunking down $20, all of you that do that. Hey, listen, if I had $100 million sitting in the bank or 7 million people listening, I'd only charge a dollar. And until we get to that point, it's just you and me. Thanks very much. Safe travels. Until next time, adios.